I'm really glad to be here today. And without much ado, I'm going to just begin telling you about what's in this and many other bills now before Congress. The president has pledged to cover millions of uninsured people. Sometimes he says 46 million, sometimes 30 million. And the Congressional Budget Office has already determined that when people who were previously uninsured receive coverage, they will use about twice as many visits to the doctor and about 70% more health care services overall. At the same time that the president has made that pledge, he's also promised to reduce the annual growth in health care spending by 25% a year. Slowing the flow of dollars into health care will mean cuts in hospital budgets, nurses spread thinner, fewer MRIs and other diagnostic equipment, and waits for treatment. This at the same time that he is inviting or allowing access to the full use of the system by millions more people. This bill, H.R. 3200, and this is only the first half of H.R. 3200, but it has the pages that I'm going to cite, so that's why I brought this half. This, yes. Well, in fact, I've handed out some very important graphs and also citations. And if you start at the beginning with me and go through this, sharing it with your neighbor, you'll see some of the passages I'm going to discuss. So we'll get to those in just a moment, but have them ready. So this bill states on the opening page that there are two goals to be fulfilled by this legislation. One is to provide coverage for the uninsured, and the other is to reduce the growth in health care spending. These two contradictory goals will lead to a lower standard of medical care, government interference in the decisions your doctor makes for you and with you, and the loss of something really as precious as life itself, your liberty. Now, the president has promised, and he's repeated this promise many times, for example, September 19th when he addressed the joint session of Congress, and you'll see this on the first slide. The president promised that if you like your health plan, you can keep it. But this bill proves that that's not true. As you'll see, you will have to give up the plan you currently have and enroll in the plan the government wants you to have. If you get your health plan through your employer will have a grace period. You'll see it right there on pages 16 to 17, slide number 2. But then after that grace period, your employer will be legally required to enroll you in what they call the qualified government design plan. If you get your insurance yourself rather than through work, you will not have a grace period. You will have to enroll in the government design qualified plan as soon as anything in your current insurance contract changes, your copay, your deductible, or any of the benefits. When you go to file your income taxes, you will have to attach to your tax return written proof from your insurer that you are enrolled in what the government deems the qualified plan. Or you could be subject to thousands of dollars in fines. Now, 18 months after this bill or something like it, such as the Baucus bill, it's not a bill yet, is passed, a Health Choices Commissioner appointed by the president will, with the advice of 5 medical advisors appointed by the president, determine the important questions about your care, what your plan will cover, how much leeway your doctor will have, and what you will be legally required to pay for your health insurance. That's like a banker handing you a loan agreement today and saying, sign here, and 18 months from now, I'm going to fill in the interest rate and the terms of repayment. Because the important decisions about your care are being delegated to appointees of the president, it's important to know what their views are. So let's meet two who are already playing a very important role in the president's healthcare decision making. If you turn the page, you'll see the pictures of Dr. David Blumenthal and Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, two highly educated, very widely published doctors who are intent on using government controls to limit your healthcare consumption and duplicate the European-style, skimpier healthcare consumption model, sort of a government-imposed model of medical scarcity. First, Dr. David Blumenthal. He has written extensively that government controls should be used to push down healthcare consumption and, by inference, standard of care to what everyone, including the poorest in society, can afford, or to what government can afford, government meaning taxpayers, obviously, can afford to provide to everyone equally. So one of the important goals, he believes, and this addresses an issue that was raised earlier, is to reduce or eliminate disparities in healthcare consumption based on ability to pay. Now, Dr. Blumenthal, as you'll see in the next slide, Dr. Blumenthal concedes that government controls will lead to discontent among patients and doctors because of waits for treatment and reduced access to newer medical innovations, newer drugs, newer devices. But he calls it debatable whether the timely care Americans currently receive is worth the extra price. Of course, if you ask a cancer patient, you'll get a different answer, because delays in diagnosis or treatment when you have cancer can be deadly. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, the other key advisor, is a very blunt talker. He talks very bluntly about what will be required to achieve savings in the healthcare system. He says, it will not be pain-free. Quote, vague promises of savings from wellness and prevention programs, the use of medical records, eliminating waste. He says these things, which the president mentions frequently, are more lipstick cost control, more for PR and show than for real change. Dr. Emanuel is right. The CBO scores these issues, reducing waste, use of electronic medical technology, prevention and wellness programs, as providing very little change in overall healthcare consumption. Emanuel argues that the Hippocratic Oath is largely to blame for what he calls the overuse of medical care. The trouble is, he says, doctors focus too much on the needs of their own patient without thinking about the impact on society. He says doctors should be retrained to think more broadly and to ask the question, is this patient worth spending all this money on? Or could the money be better spent on another patient or on education or the arts? Many doctors find this kind of thinking outrageous, although it's not just Emanuel. There's a whole new school of encouraging doctors to look beyond the needs of their own patient. But doctors Emanuel and Blumenthal have argued extensively that government controls need to be used to reduce your doctor's leeway, your doctor's ability to make these decisions in order to cut costs. And the framework for these controls was slipped into the stimulus package, signed into law on February 17th. A provision in that law says that protocols will be delivered to doctors electronically on what the government deems appropriate and cost-effective care. And doctors who are not meaningful users of this new computer-guided medical system and I should say meaningful user is a term of art in the bill that will be defined at the discretion of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who is specifically empowered to make the definition, quote, more stringent over time. Doctors who are not meaningful users of the system, as the Secretary defines that word, will be subject to financial penalties beginning in 2014. Now, when this bill was passed into law, I wrote several articles warning that the government was about to interfere substantially in the decisions your doctor makes for you. And CNN, Elizabeth Cohen, said, not true. She's not telling the truth. Factcheck.org said, not true. But in March, the president appointed David Blumenthal National Coordinator of Health Information Technology. And on April 9th in the New England Journal of Medicine, he settled that debate. You'll see in the next slide. Embedded clinical decision support, his phrase for computers telling doctors what to do, he says is a very important part of this new system. And he predicts that if the controls are too tight, doctors will petition Congress to repeal that part of the stimulus legislation or reconcile themselves to denying patients, to reconcile themselves to the penalties rather than denying patients the care they need. So when you hear the president say, nothing in these bills will interfere in your doctor's decision-making, that's not true, because similar incentives and penalties are in this bill, too, very broadly speaking, impact that will impact your doctor's decision-making. And in the Baucus bill, I'm going to talk about one of those in a minute. It is undeniably true that medical knowledge is increasing at such a pace. Half of all the clinical trials, the gold standard of research, half of all the clinical trials done in the history of medicine have been done in the last 10 years, imagine, right? It is undeniably true that so much research is being done in medicine and knowledge is changing so quickly that even subspecialists who read voraciously have a hard time keeping up. So what could be better than delivering that research and summaries of it, even guidelines, to doctors electronically? Wonderful. But that is different from making them legally required to follow protocols, because this research is done on the average patient, not the patient with several comorbidities or medical conditions, not the elderly patient. And so you don't want your doctor being legally required to do what is good for the average patient. This bill, and the Baucus bill, which I hope we'll discuss in a moment, this bill is a medical assault on seniors and baby boomers going into Medicare. The price tag for this bill is somewhere between $1 trillion and $1.6 trillion. A lot of it, a little more than half of it, is paid for with tax hikes. We've all heard about those. But half of it is paid with a $500 billion reduction in future Medicare spending over the next decade. That's about a 10% reduction in future Medicare funding, at the same time that 30% more people are going to be in Medicare as we baby boomers enter that program. Those numbers do not add up. It's the Congressional Budget Office, July 27th, said only 1% of those savings is going to come from reducing waste. It's going to mean, inevitably, fewer hip replacements, fewer knee replacements, fewer angioplasties, fewer bypass surgeries. These four procedures have literally transformed the experience of aging since the 1960s. People in those decades used to be stuck in a wheelchair in their later years because they were so crippled by arthritis, or trapped in a nursing home because their clogged arteries made them so short of breath that they couldn't walk. The progress that we've made in the last 50 years in making later years of life pleasurable, enabling people to enjoy their grandchildren and travel and really be vital. We've seen disability among the elderly decrease 2% every single year since 1987 because of procedures like this. This bill is going to undo that. Now, there is an alternative. I would say to the president, throw out this 1,000-page bill and the 859-page Kennedy bill and the Baucus plan, which is only 300 pages because it's not a bill at all yet, and give us a 20-page bill. A 20-page bill in plain English that will do one thing, cover Americans who are truly uninsured. 20 pages is all that's needed. The framers established the entire federal government in 18 pages. And we need plain English and a short bill. One of the reasons there is so much rancor in this debate is that those of us who read the bill and cite the criticisms on particular pages are answered by the administration with the vaguest reassurances and no specifics at all. So how does the public to know what is really true? A 20-page bill, you can't slip in all that pork barrel spending. The last 500 pages of the Kennedy bill is just projects like lights and playgrounds, only tangentially at best related to health. And also, in a 20-page bill, you can't slip in an exemption for members of Congress. Right? 20 pages. We could immediately provide purchasing power through a certificate, a debit card already in use in all 50 states to deliver food purchasing power to people who need assistance, a voucher. There are many ways to do it. We could deliver purchasing power for the 12 to 15, you'll see that pie chart if you're, are you still following along? There you are. That's okay. We could cover the 12 to 15 million Americans who are truly uninsured for between $28 billion and $49 billion a year, depending on what kind of insurance we provided. A high deductible plan, for example, a $1,000 deductible, would cost $49 billion, and we could cover every single uninsured American. Now, over a decade, we could do that with the unused stimulus money still sitting in the pot. People say, well, we should take that money back and reduce the deficit. I agree. But that's not politically realistic. That money is either going to go for trees sitting in the middle of a parking lot or to solve a major issue and get it off the table politically. So we could cover all the uninsured in America for the next decade with that stimulus funding. We could do it without cutting Medicare, without raising taxes, without adding to the deficit, right? And without dismantling one of the best healthcare systems in the world. You know, and then we could pass another 20-page bill to address the tort reform issue and another 20-page bill to address other deficiencies. 20 pages at a time, Americans could actually feel that they have a part in this debate instead of this. When the president addressed Congress on September 9th, he didn't say one good thing about American medicine. Not one. I'm in hospitals every day. I see doctors and nurses literally rescue patients from the brink of death every day. He had nothing good to say about them. But the fact is, if you're seriously ill, the United States is one of the best places to be. A woman who gets breast cancer in the United States has over a 90% chance of surviving it. In Europe, it's less than 80%. And those statistics include everybody, not just people with insurance. The World Health Organization rates us number one out of 191 nations for responsiveness to the needs of patients. And if somebody in your family has what we currently say is an incurable disease, this is the nation of hope. This is where the new treatments are developed, the new breakthroughs. I just looked the other day. Since 1950, the United States has won more Nobel Prizes in medicine and physiology than the entire rest of the world combined. Canada, the nation that's often discussed as an alternative model, single payer, hasn't won one Nobel Prize in medicine and physiology since 1950, not one. Now, of course, the question that's raised by the president and others is this standard of medical excellence and this pace of innovation sustainable? The president says, no, it's not sustainable. Max Baucus says, no, it's not sustainable. The late Senator Kennedy said, it's not sustainable. But the evidence says it's sustainable. Take a look at that first line chart. There we are. The first line chart, you'll see two lines crossing. Since 1960, the United States, Americans in the United States, have had to spend less and less of their spending capacity on food and energy. That's true with all countries as they become more sophisticated. That's allowed Americans to spend an increasing share of their spending capacity on a third necessity, healthcare. But these three necessities together, turn the page, consume exactly the same part of the American spending pie now as in 1960, exactly 29%. Add a fourth necessity, housing, and you'll see that it's a steady, absolutely steady 48%. As further proof that healthcare is not breaking the American economy or breaking American families, as you often hear, take a look at the next chart. And you'll see that Americans are choosing to spend an increasing share of their spending capability on recreation and outings. That is not the sign of a nation in crisis, right? Americans spend more on health care than Europeans because they can afford more. 90% of the difference between what Americans and Europeans spend per capita on healthcare is due to higher incomes in the United States. We spend more because we earn more and we get more for it. For example, higher cancer survival rates. Now, these averages don't apply to every family. And a family that can't afford health insurance should be helped. As I just mentioned, there are several ways we can do that. Nobody should lose a home because they can't afford health insurance. But you hear people in Washington constantly say, this is an economic crisis. We do have a third-party payer crisis, and that's what I'd like to talk about. First of all, every day when you pick up the newspaper, you hear about skyrocketing premiums, right? Skyrocketing. There are two reasons for these skyrocketing premiums. And they both are the fault of politicians. I can say that because I was one, right? Okay, the first reason is the rapid decline in the share of health care that's paid for out of the consumer's pocket. You'll see the bar graph there. It used to be that Americans paid for at least a third of their health care out of pocket. Now it's down to 15%. How did that happen? Politicians. I remember my first day in office as Lieutenant Governor in 1994. I arrived at this beautiful Capitol where I'd never been before, and there was a long line of lobbyists outside the door. First in line was the chiropractors, and third in line was the acupuncturists. They wanted me to support legislation that would require that every health plan sold in New York State include unlimited acupuncture services and unlimited chiropractic services. After all, they said, we both had a lot to gain. I'd get a big campaign contribution, and they'd get a big fee from their clients. Only one person would lose, the public, right? They had a lot to lose. Well, unfortunately, most lawmakers in New York State thought that was a terrific idea, and that's why insurance is so incredibly expensive in New York. It's like passing a law that the only car you can buy is a fully loaded Cadillac. Some people can only afford a Volkswagen, And driving is better than walking, right? So when I hear skyrocketing premiums for health insurance, I say, you know, if suddenly your car insurance included every tune-up, every oil change, every trip to the car wash, we'd have skyrocketing car insurance premiums too, right? You're buying something different now. The second reason that premiums are skyrocketing is even more interesting and more the fault of politicians. Turn to the pie chart on the next page. And it's going to get much worse. Pretend that circle is a hospital. Hospitals are paid three ways. Medicare pays about 93 cents for every dollar of care delivered. Medicaid pays 86 cents. They both shortchange the hospitals. But hospitals are able to keep their doors open because they're able to squeeze $1.32 out of private insurers for every dollar of care delivered. Now, you see that private wedge there, the private insurance wedge? It's going to shrink really fast this year. First, we have 30% more people in Medicare, right? The HR 3200 adds 10 million more people in Medicaid, right? And then with the public option, which is going to pay hospitals at the Medicare rate, that private sector is going to be smaller than a little slice of pizza. Hospitals are going to be operating at a real loss, and it's going to mean, as I said at the very beginning, nurses spread very thin, less equipment, and a lower standard of care. Right now, when you write your premium check, you're paying about $1,788 of that premium, not for people in your insurance pool, but rather because the government is shortchanging the hospitals. It's a cost shift, right? It's a typical government broken promise. We'll pay for that guy, only they're really not paying for him. You are. So when you add up the $1,788 cost shift because the government shortchanges the hospitals, plus the $1,000 you pay to compensate for uncompensated care for the uninsured, about $2,700 of the average insurance premium now is for these things that have nothing to do with the care of people in the pool, in your insurance pool. And it's going to get much worse. So it's not so much that the premiums are going to go up more, the care is going to go way down. Right? Now, there's another third-party payer problem. I mentioned it before, Medicare. I constantly hear people in Washington say, and it's really facetious, we have to hold down what everyone is spending on health care or Medicare is going to go bankrupt even sooner. That's like saying the food stamp program is in trouble, so everyone in the United States has to go on a diet and buy fewer groceries. No. The answer is to reduce the share of health care paid for by these third parties. In the case of Medicare, we can rescue Medicare. The Congressional Budget Office has assured us that we can put Medicare on a firm financial footing without altering the standard of care. If we inch up the eligibility age 1 month a year, every year until 2043 when it reaches age 70, an imperceptible change for any individual, and yet sufficient to address the huge demographic challenge we're facing. The good news is that the trend is our friend. Although healthcare spending is increasing more rapidly than overall inflation, we shouldn't call it inflation, I'll tell you why in a second, healthcare spending is increasing far slower than in previous decades. It increased 10.5% in the 70s. It increased 13% a year in the 80s. It's down to 6.1% now. So it's really much more under control than it used to be. Two-thirds of that increase is due to innovation. Walk into an electronics store, and you'll see things on the shelf that weren't there a couple of years ago, like people your age, iPods, things I don't even know how to use, right? Walk into a hospital and you'll see the same thing. New technologies to undo stroke damage, to help people survive heart attacks, to enable us to conquer arthritis and many, many more things. It's really dazzling. It has enabled us to transform the experience of aging. And that's not just for Americans. These innovations are our most important humanitarian foreign aid. It's like a medical Marshall Plan for an aging globe, right? So we have two choices. We can follow the current proposal and its vision of controlling healthcare costs by pushing the standard down, by allowing government to dictate what your doctor does, by tolerating huge layoffs, because when you slow the flow of dollars into healthcare, it's going to mean big layoffs. Healthcare employs 10 times as many people in the U.S. as Chrysler and General Motors. Right? In my state, 30% of the Bronx is in healthcare, 30% of the workforce in Brooklyn, too. And it's going to slow the search for new cures. Or we have an alternative. We can recognize that healthcare is the most important part of the denominator. You know, you hear 17% of GDP? Healthcare is a big chunk of the denominator. It's one of our most important sources of employment, one of our most important sources of technological leadership in the world, right? It's enhancing the quality of life, especially for the elderly. So as an alternative, we can appreciate that, preserve that, and cope with the challenges of the third-party payment challenge, right? And ensure that this pace of innovation continues. To me, it's obvious what the right choice is. But there's something even more obvious, and that is, even for those who disagree with my values about this or yours, we ought to have an open debate. And right now, that is not happening. Dr. Emanuel wrote last December that the way to push this healthcare bill through is to make it clear to companies all across the U.S., if you want a bailout, you have to support the president's health proposal and get your suppliers to do it as well. And you see industry after industry lining up. But this is not the way to make an important decision in our country. Just yesterday, Senator Kyle offered an amendment to the Senate Finance Committee that the Baucus markup, which is taking shape day by day very rapidly, when it becomes a bill, the Congress should have 72 hours to read it, 72 hours, and receive a CBO scoring. And it was defeated, 10 to 13. Nancy Pelosi said no. That is not democracy. That's not what we stand for. So this is the fight of our lifetimes, not just for the protection of our medical system and our future medical care, but also for the most fundamental privilege of self-government. Thank you.
Sally?
See, that was terrific, and I agree with, you know, everything that you say. And I
well, then let's talk right here.
I thought just, you know, we can open it up. People have questions about the Canadian healthcare system and the long waiting lists and all these things. When government, you know, Canada, there are only two countries in the world that have a single payer healthcare system. One is Canada, the other is North Korea. And so people need to think about that. And when, you know, when the president says we spend 16% of our GDP on healthcare, Canada spends 10%, we should be spending 10%. I don't know, I mean, 16% may be too little because we have such a great demand for healthcare and we have the very best and innovation is expensive. But in Canada, what happened, when the government took over the healthcare system 35 years ago, private health insurance is outlawed. What happened was they had no idea what the demand for healthcare would be when people think something is free. As a result, they had to set a global budget and they set it at 10%. But what happened is that the demand was much greater, and so you have in Canada today long waiting lists for care, ration care, and lack of access to the latest technology and diagnostics. So today the average wait in Canada from seeing a primary care doctor to getting treatment by a specialist is 17.3 weeks. That's over 4 months. When you hear the president on Letterman saying, you know, Canadians, the polls show that Canadians like their healthcare system. Well, the polls, that the poll numbers that you see of Canadians who like their healthcare system, most people aren't sick. The people that don't need to get a specialist or specialist care, that's fine. You know, if you have a sore throat, whatever. But the issue is when you poll the people who need specialized care, the numbers plummet. The third point is that the Canadian government, as I said, took over the healthcare system 35 years ago. You weren't born 35 years ago. You weren't alive 35 years ago, I don't think. The question is, Canadians don't know any different. You know, they think, well, what it is what it is. And, you know, as my mom used to say to me, I hope you're not becoming an impatient American. Well, you know what, Canadians, when the doctor says, you have to wait 4 months to get an MRI, they say, well, thank you very much. But 30,000 Canadians every year out of a population of 32 million, fewer people than in the state of California, 30,000 Canadians every year come to the United States and pay out of pocket for health care. That is not an insignificant number. 750,000 Canadians are on a waiting list for a procedure. 17% or 5 million out of 32 million are waiting to get a primary care doctor. So when you hear the president say we can cut costs if we have more people in primary care, we will not get more people in primary care. Doctors in Canada are union members. Their provincial medical association negotiates with the provincial government. My cousin, who is a corneal transplant specialist, came to have dinner with Charles and myself in March, and he offered to pay for dinner. I was like, wow. And he said, I had a COLA adjustment. Charles was like, a COLA adjustment? He had his first cost of living adjustment as a high-risk doctor in 4 years. And they have global budgets. At the end of November, David can't do any more corneal transplants because his budget is up. Is this what we want for the American people? And I think the answer is no. And so when the president says, you know, well, I don't really want a Canadian-style system, just go back and look at his speeches to the AFL-CIO. If I were designing a healthcare system from scratch, I would design a single-payer system. Look at Barney Frank from Massachusetts when interviewed on the TV. I support single payer. We don't have the votes for it now, but if we get the public option, that is going to take us down that path to a single payer system. Harry Reid, we're going to get some kind of a public option. Call it a co-op, call it whatever you like, but we're going to get there. All of these things are taking us down the path to what Betsy has told you. So I would like to ask Betsy the first question, and then I'll open it up to you. Get off my soapbox.
This was not rehearsed.
On September 9th, we all, well, most of us who had to write immediately after the speech, which went on for 48 minutes, his 29th speech on healthcare, the president's 29th, he said, my bill will cost $900 billion over 10 years. We have to have it deficit neutral. One of the things we're going to do is cut fraud and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid, probably about $450 billion over 10 years. Well, do you not find it astounding that those are two programs run by the government that are racked with fraud and abuse? And so why is it that...
Why isn't it cut it already?
Why haven't they first cut out fraud and abuse and then say, well, now we've got an efficient Medicare and Medicaid system, these programs are going to be bankrupt by 2017. And, you know, Medicare in 1990 was supposed to cost $12 billion. It cost $110 billion. So how are we going to get a $1 trillion, $1.6 trillion plan, according to what politicians are telling us?
Oh, well, one of the things I'm very concerned about is how government reduces cost in health care. It's a very blunt instrument. It would be wonderful if government... if some smart doctors working for the government could look at each patient's chart and say, you just had an MRI last week, maybe we can wait a little longer. But that's not how it's done. RAND has done some marvelous studies comparing the degree of unnecessary care in public systems and market systems. And they've regretfully concluded that the degree of wasteful care or unnecessary care or duplicative care is about the same. What happens is that most countries that have global budgets and need to control overall healthcare spending because it's taxpayer funded use cutoffs. For example, in Canada, it's very tough to get certain heart procedures done if you're over 65. That sounds really young to me.
It gets younger every day.
Right. And The Baucus bill has a provision on page 81 that I call the race to the bottom provision. It provides that the doctors who are working for Medicare each year will be profiled, as many insurance companies do. And the doctors who are in the top 10% for spending will be penalized. Every year that will be done, no matter how the costs shift, so that doctors will always have to think, am I going to do the right thing for my patient, or will this be the decision that pushes me into that category? Way back in 1990, when managed care was first launched in the U.S., there was a technique that HMOs used. We all worked very hard and got it outlawed. It was called the withhold. HMOs would contract with doctors to pay so much per patient per month, capitation. And they would withhold about 10 to 15% of that payment until the end of the year and give it back only to the doctors who met stringent targets for limiting how many diagnostic tests or how many days in the hospital, how many referrals to specialists their patients got. So literally what a doctor prescribed for the patient came out of the doctor's own pocket at the end of the year. It set up such a conflict of interest between you and your doctor that starting with the state of Delaware, we finally got it outlawed in one state after another. The withhold is back in the Baucus bill, right? So people who have a short memory about what we've achieved in protecting the practice of medicine from these insidious practices don't recognize these devices when they're being slipped into this legislation.
So I think we should open up to some questions from the floor. Yes. Dan, person behind you first.
I obviously agree with all of what you said. Isn't part of the problem that the healthcare situation is just part of a bigger problem, and that if we look at the U.S. economy in the last 20 years based on the performance that it would have achieved based on our monetary policies alone, had we not been fortunate enough to have the internet, fortunate enough to have innovation with computers and cell phones and communications that improved the efficiencies of businesses by 4 or 5 times, had we not been fortunate enough to have a totalitarian one-party state like China flood our market with cheap goods, had we not been fortunate enough to build up the hugest amount of debt in world history to finance this illusion of prosperity and keep our prices down, had we not been fortunate enough when we looked at our irresponsible monetary policies alone, the collapse that we're beginning to see now would have happened a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we can't count on that good fortune to go on indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is, if we just look at the healthcare situation from the very correct perspective that you have, but we don't deal with this issue of monetary policy and the problems that it's created and the toxic assets issues, the derivatives issues, well, you're talking about possibly $60 to $100 trillion that are now in question. We don't look at these bigger issues that could begin a real economic apocalypse, and we don't bring that into the picture. Then what's going to happen is we're going to hand the initiative to our opponents because we're discrediting the free market system itself by not bringing in an understanding of the desperate need for sound monetary policy, which will force honesty in these issues and an honest evaluation of these issues that will bring a better result. Because even if we win this healthcare debate, but we don't deal with this fundamental issue, then the costs are going to continue to go up, these issues will continue, and there will always be the cry, as there have been throughout history, for government to come in and solve the problem. And we know that it will just make it worse.
I'd like to ask if there's someone in the audience who can address that. I'm not a monetary specialist. I know that it's an important issue.
As Milton Friedman, my mentor, and who wrote the foreword to my first book on the Canadian healthcare system, you're absolutely right. I am very, very worried. I think one of the problems we have is that the American people elected Obama on hope and change. They didn't think that
small change.
And they didn't think that change could be good and change can be bad. But I think that the president's overarching view is that he believes that government can run our lives better than we can run it ourselves. And so when you look at what he wants, it's not just about health care or the environment. He wants universal daycare. He wants universal preschool. He wants all kinds of things because in Hillary's book, remember Hillary's book, It Takes a Village, and that village is government. And I think, you know, the president wants that for the American people. When you look at, if Milton were alive today, he would say, you know, we are going to be in for a huge bout of inflation because how are we going to pay for, you know, TARP and the stimulus bill and the budget? And then just yesterday they said, I read, watching in the Chicago airport, you know, we need to think about bailouts for smaller banks. And so all of this is going to lead to, we're going to have to pay more in taxes, and we're going to also see that this is going to add to inflation in this country, not today or tomorrow, but within the next couple of years, because it has to be paid for. And it's going to lead to the demise. You know, Pan Am was a fabulous airline at one time. But, you know, just because you're at the top once doesn't mean you're going to be at the top forever. And I believe that just because America's been a great country, and I left Canada to come for the land of opportunity, I think we can go down and other countries like India and China are going to be economies that, that surpass us. And it's going to be a shame.
Dan. Oh, Dan had a question, I think.
Oh, sorry.
Private sector with a free market incentive is very capable of providing a self-corrective mechanism in healthcare costs. By the two of the biggest are WellPoint, which is the Blue Cross Blue Shield Network, UnitedHealth, and Kaiser Permanente. They all have enormous databases, and they are constantly improving their analysis of those databases and policing, because it's to their economic interest to do so, cost per doctor, cost per hospital. So it doesn't just run without any self-corrective mechanism. The problems, I think, are what we've diagnosed earlier. You have more and more requirements put on the medical system, which increases the overall carrying cost. It's not necessarily the market sector itself that's out killed.
And in addition, it seems to me that people in Washington talk about healthcare the way Europeans do, as a cost problem rather than a growth industry. The real problem is the third-party payer. But in fact, if you look at healthcare itself, it's a source of such innovation. It's a very big chunk of the denominator. When we talk about percentage of GDP, why would we be bailing out the auto industry and suddenly put a lid on spending in the healthcare industry when it has so much promise for us? The fact is that people in Washington are so federal-centric that if they have a budget problem, they think it's a national problem. We can rescue Medicare. I suggested one way. The CBO has some other suggestions as well. We could rescue Medicaid, and we could help employers all by reducing their obligation to pick up the tab for health care, rather than attempting to lower the standard of consumption in healthcare, because it is such an important growth industry for us.
I think the problem is who's union paying for it.
Yes, exactly. But also, I'll get you into a second. Also, when you look at those charts, what's really surprising and interesting about those charts, and there's no debate about this on the left or the right, economists like Uwe Reinhardt, and Victor Fuchs, very far to the left, very strong supporters of the Obama administration, have written again and again that healthcare could consume as much as 25% of GDP before it would begin forcing Americans to actually forego, on average, other types of goods and services. So it's not that we can't afford this standard of care. The reason people in the administration are attempting to push down the overall standard of care is for a very different ideological reason, and that is to eliminate disparities based on ability to pay.
And certainly very few people in America, and certainly no one in Canada realizes, people in Canada think the United States is a free market in healthcare. 47% of our healthcare industry today is in the hands of government, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, state children's health insurance plan, just bumped up by another $32 billion, and the VA system. So we have a lot of government in our healthcare system, and a lot of politicians and people like Uwe Reinhart want to take over that other 53%. And I think, you know, we have some solutions.
And we are near the tipping point.
We are, absolutely. Right. And then when you hear the president say, well, administrative costs in Medicare are 2 to 3%. In the private sector, the well points in that they're gouging people. Well, Medicare only has one function. It's to pay claims out to doctors. And actually, that's private contracted out to private carriers. But the private sector, insurance companies, they have to build networks. They have to compete with other insurers. They have to advertise. And they have to eliminate fraud and abuse. You don't see that level of fraud and abuse in the private sector that you do in Medicare and Medicaid. So when you see people say admin costs in Medicare are so low, therefore we should have this plan for everybody, they're not comparing apples to apples, and they have tremendous fraud.
There's a man in the back. Yes, sir.
I don't know if there are any other physicians in this group, but we'll follow you anyway. I wonder if you could comment on the stands that AARP and AMA are taking.
Yes. Well, the AMA represents about 17% of physicians in the United States. Many people are led to believe that they represent all of them. But fortunately now, many of the specialty societies, subspecialty societies, and the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons have all taken stands contrary to what the AMA has taken. And it's really shocking that the AMA has so strongly supported legislation that will tie the hands of doctors and prevent people who are not educated in medicine, allow people who are not educated in medicine to actually dictate medical decisions. It's shocking to me. They did it for a seat at the table. The AARP, I know everyone thinks about the AARP as a not-for-profit advocacy group for seniors, but really they're a giant insurance company. And they have strongly advocated for the Obama administration's proposals in defiance or in betrayal of the interests of their own members. And they are losing about 50,000 members a month because of that, because people realize that, seniors realize that they are bearing the brunt under this kind of legislation. So there are alternative organizations now starting up to replace AARP.
I'm just going to make one quick point.
What kind of medicine?
Recent poll came out showing that 45% of doctors would quit medicine if this HR 3200 or the Baucus bill becomes a law. And that's the situation in Canada, that why 17% of Canadians are waiting for docs. And you also don't get the best kids going into medicine because they know their income is controlled, they can't practice the type of medicine. One thing I've just done is set up the Benjamin Rush Society, which is a version of the Federal Society for medical students, because when we did our poll at our Columbia debate, 64% of the med students, 200 in this audience, were for single-payer health care. After Brian Day, an orthopedic surgeon who practices illegally in Vancouver, and I finished, we were at 62%. But we've got a real problem. The young people in this country are in medical schools, and they're only being taught by docs in the teaching hospitals and the universities about why single payer is great. It's a devastation for all of us, and, mm-hmm. and for us when we become seniors at Betsy.
Yeah. We won't discuss when that's going to happen.
Last question.
Yes, sir.
My question relates solely to Medicare. It sounds to me in your presentation that you're very protective of those who are already receiving Medicare. And what I'm concerned about is that those of us, including me, who receive Medicare and prescription drug coverage, we never paid a premium for a prescription drug. We never paid a tax for a prescription drug. So 25% of the prescription drug costs are being borne by us, and we passed on 75% to all those younger people that we say we're worried about. Medicare Part A, once we retire, we don't pay any tax or any premium. That trust fund is supposed to be bankrupt in 9 years. You have said, in effect, I thought, that we should still get all those benefits and not pay more, even though we didn't pay adequately for it, and pass it on to the next generation.
Okay.
I think that's fundamentally wrong, and I think that we need to address that.
Well, let's raise three interesting issues, two of which were raised by the CBO in their December 2008 report on this. One is the Congressional Budget Office did propose that we consider asking seniors who have large assets or high income to pay a larger premium, as particularly for Medicare Part B. So that's something to discuss. Secondly, as I mentioned before, we can put Medicare on a firm footing for the next generation by changing the eligibility age, and I think it's a really smart idea because, after all, that age 65 cutoff was invented, believe it or not, by Bismarck in 1897. It's an anachronism. Pertaining just to the prescription drug coverage, I was a very strong supporter of Medicare Part D drug coverage, even though it's not a conservative position. And the reason is this. The science shows that new pharmaceutical products, and I emphasize new, keep patients out of the hospital and off the operating table. They are highly cost-effective in reducing the rate of overall healthcare spending in the Medicare budget. Frank Lichtenberg's work at Columbia has been particularly persuasive in this. Anesthesia-reversing drugs are one example. Natricor for congestive heart failure. It's not used anymore, but it reduced hospitalization for patients with congestive heart failure 81%. So ponying up to pay the drug costs produced very compelling savings in inpatient hospital care in the Medicare system.
Yep. For Frank's work showed that for every $1 spent in newer pharmaceuticals, we were saving $7.17 in hospital costs. I was against Medicare Part D, not in principle, but because only 2% of people were actually at the income level where they needed help. I thought it should have been means tested so that those people who could afford it would not be, we wouldn't make this huge, the largest entitlement since the Johnson Great Society, and now we're looking at an even bigger entitlement under Obamacare. Betsy, great job. Thank you. And thank you, Natalie.
Yeah.